that there must be some terrifying secret being kept in the basement. Something is up. Nobody is that cool. In this day and age, when the social norm is to behave in quite the opposite fashion of their unflagging generosity, we really won the neighbor lottery with these two. Part of Adam's incredible powers has to do specifically with our shared interests, which also happen to mostly be subjects that are very helpful around a domicile. He likes woodworking, carpentry, home construction in general, so also plumbing, electrical, masonry, etc., for all of which he collects and maintains the necessary tools and fasteners. He keeps an immaculately organized garage. History also fascinates him, and he likes scotch. So come on. He's like a superhero called The Neighbor. Of course, I had discussed my plan with him for driving the Airstream home and attempting to park it. Wouldn't you know it, when I first arrived there with the nutmeg, he had coned off the spots by our house that I was hoping to occupy for the next week, as we loaded her up for our Thanksgiving road trip. As it turned out, I was in fact able to turn our travel train around successfully, taking it very carefully, and so now we had arrived at the moment of truth, backing into the spot. The basic rule for backing up a towed trailer is this. If you want the ass of the trailer to go right, you steer the ass of your vehicle left, and vice versa. Once you can get on top of this weird push-me-pull-you feeling, the rest comes pretty easily. As I prepared to give it my first attempt, I had a devastating realization. With the normal SUV side mirrors on the Expedition, I was 100% unable to see around the sides of the nutmeg, rendering me completely blind in terms of being able to essentially parallel park. This looked like a job for the neighbor. Adam nimbly landed from leaping over a tall building, and with his aid, I was able to smoothly snug our Airstream into her berth in a mere 27 tries. Phew! Via a couple of adapters, I was able to plug the 50-amp electrical cable into an exterior 110-volt outlet on my garage that was close enough to the street to be accessible. We turned on the Globetrotter's lights, and I carried Megan gingerly up the little steps and across the threshold, and Lord, it was fine. She spent the next few days installing the garage's worth of accessories, filling up the refrigerator and freezer, and making this beautiful land ship into our home. The majesty of her talents was being made fully manifest in this aluminum lozenge that a few months earlier we never would have dreamed we'd own. But the pandemic changed a lot of priorities for a lot of people, and this was no exception. I turned down some nice acting jobs to take this trip, which Megan had now fleshed out to a couple of months, with several stops throughout the Southwest. In many ways, the world felt strangely on pause, and there would, hopefully, be more acting jobs later. She had put into this vehicle and this journey a veritable assload of extremely hard work and affection, and donkey that I am, I still knew better than to miss it. While she was working the interior up into the 2020 Love Nest equivalent of the bottle from I Dream of Jeannie, I was finally able to pull my head out of my exit and begin my contribution. I first dove into the manual and learned all about the Ford Expedition and its tow package, and really all the newfangled systems you can get in your car nowadays. I still feel like I'm in Battlestar Galactica if a vehicle just has power windows, so this bonkers luxury wagon, which legitimately has the capability to both heat and cool the two front captain's chairs, while they also operate as massage chairs, is, pardon my French, fucking stupefiant. I dug out the spare tire and the fast, furious jack system, which seems to get increasingly adorable as the years go by, which is perhaps not the ideal adjective I want describing my safety equipment. I changed a tire for Megan recently on her Audi, and that model currently comes with a compact, deflated, folded spare and tiny compressor that you have to plug into the 12-volt outlet in the car to then inflate this spare while making a very bad noise. Like if a mosquito and a trim router had a baby that could really sing. As the spare inflates, it unfolds and suddenly pops open through a couple of tiers of openness, which scared the pants off of me on behalf of anybody who has to countenance this action for the first time on a dark road some night. The engineering is neato, but I'm not sure I want to trust the whole finicky process over the clumsiness of carrying a slightly larger, already inflated spare. I digress, apparently. It's a moot argument these days anyway, since the percentage of times an ill-prepared person will get a flat where they're out of cell range or the reach of some help like AAA or a tow service is pretty infinitesimal. I just happen to love changing tires. It is an unexpected problem that I can tangibly solve with the tools to hand, and that makes me feel great when it happens. Let me put it this way. I'd rather be faced with changing a flat tire than be asked to download yet another convenient new app so that I can try and fail to view some video content or other through a website that has Box in the name. Once I had a firm enough grip on the expedition's bells and whistles, I turned my attention to the Airstream, the Nutmeg herself, which is a damn impressive tub full of engineering accomplishments. I learned all about the trailer itself, including the brakes and the signal lights that plug into the Ford, so that all of my driving maneuvers, like braking and turn signals, are communicated by the lights on the hindquarters of the Airstream. I learned about the onboard water system that supplies a kitchen sink, a bathroom sink, a shower, a toilet, and even a little outdoor shower rig, should things get that groovy somewhere outside of Barstow. I learned about the black water toilet tank, including how and when to properly empty it out at the appropriate facilities. And also details that wouldn't have occurred to me, like how to make all of this plumbing operate successfully, even if you're staying where the weather is below freezing. I learned about the propane stove, oven, hot water heater, and furnace, which are fueled by a couple of 7-gallon tanks that ride on the tongue of the trailer. Depending on the temperature outside, the furnace sometimes works in tandem with an electric heat pump on the roof, in a unit that also houses the air conditioner. There are 2 good-sized TVs, a stereo speaker system, and a pretty decent refrigerator and freezer. Throw in a bunch of LED lights throughout the joint, and there were more than enough details to keep this prospective streamer occupied. The Globetrotter's electrical system is a little complicated, especially if your tool specialty happens to reside in woodworking, like that of your humble correspondent. Thanks to my handy dad, I am competent with the basics of plumbing and electricity, but as soon as things get more complex than, say, switching out an outlet box, I like to consult a more knowledgeable technician. If the problem is straightforward, like my plugging a skill saw into a house circuit without realizing that Megan is also running a hollow chisel mortiser on the same line, and we blow the breaker, I can usually parse the issue, reset the breaker, and find another circuit for my sawing needs. The system in the Nutmeg is a whole other animal. It's a pretty deluxe version, as RV electrical systems go, as it needs to juice the rooftop heat pump air conditioner, the refrigerator freezer, and a microwave, all on top of the basic lighting and entertainment needs. In ideal settings, nice RV parks, we just park in our allocated spot and plug a massive 50-amp cable into a convenient 50-amp outlet, and then simply fire up the whole casino with the clack of a big satisfying switch. Neat, clean, no muss, no fuss, right? Sure, in the ideal case. Less than ideal cases involve parks that only have 30-amp outlets available, which means I can't blow-dry my hair and microwave my lasagna at the same time. Or when you want to camp in places with few to no electrical hookups, like the wilderness, for example, and you have to then judiciously depend upon the backup system, which is battery-powered. Nestled on the tongue of the trailer, between the front wall of the camper and the standing aluminum compartment that houses your two propane tanks, is a lidded metal box housing two vehicle batteries. These maintain a punch of 12 volts, and they are trickle-charged whenever your 50-amp rig is plugged into power. On top of that, the cable that plugs into the vehicle, the Expedition in my case, also diverts a trickle of juice to the batteries. This is pretty amazing, if for no other reason than it allows you to fill your fridge and freezer with weeks' worth of groceries while the Airstream is conveniently parked in front of your house, plugged into a mere 110-volt outlet, and then the batteries keep them running cold as you unplug from the DC power and head out onto the road for all-day drives. It is a perfect system. Whoops. It was not a perfect system. Again, largely thanks to my ignorance. Basically, the outlet on the house was not supplying quite enough amperage to keep things fully running, with the main draw being the fridge. So, unbeknownst to this donkey, the electrical system was sipping off of the batteries for just a little help, day in and day out, across the week, slowly draining them until I finally noticed it the night before we were scheduled to leave. Inside the trailer is a nifty little panel that displays the fluid levels in the water and waste tanks and also tells me the current voltage of my batteries. Ideally, it's going to read between 12 and 13 volts. As Megan and I were buttoning things up to get on the road the next morning, I checked the meter, and it said that the batteries were down to 9.5, then 9.1. At which point, everything basically shut down, meaning all of our refrigerated food was about to be ruined. This obviously sucked very much, especially since we were both exhausted from all the hustle and prepping things for the last week. I did what you do when the power goes out. I got ice and transferred everything into four large coolers, and we hit the hay, bone-tired but thrilled to begin our adventure the next day. I got up bright and early, raring to go, and all I had to do was, whoops, shit. And I mean, oh shit. I mean, you have got to be kidding me. The drained batteries had caused a whole new dilemma, one I hadn't even had a moment to consider. Basically, a trailer rests upon three points of contact: the wheels on each side and the hitch up front, supported by the tow vehicle. When one disconnects a trailer from said tow vehicle, the third point of the triangle is removed and must be replaced by some sort of support leg. All of the trailers I had operated in my younger days had just such an accessory that would swing down into place, and they were pretty slick. Imagine this very heavy trailer carrying a tractor or tons of lumber or a 30-foot aluminum camper, and you need to release it from the hitch. The swinging leg system works like this. You pop the lock on the ball hitch, loosening the connection. You then swing the leg down and lock it into the upright position. You then crank the top turn handle, which lowers the foot, which sometimes has a small wheel on it so the trailer can be manually push-rolled around on the wheels, until the leg takes the levered weight of the trailer. You keep cranking, and the leg continues to extend, now lifting the weight up until the front hitch rises clear of the ball, and the tow vehicle can be driven forward free and clear of the trailer. This system requires a bit of muscle and familiarity with leverage and simple machines, but it's tried and true, and as with changing a tire, I have always loved it because I know how to accomplish the heavy, potentially dangerous work it does. This work is also imperative to a successful journey-slash-project-slash-workday because it's the crux of the trailer's job. You have to be able to hook up and also consciously uncouple from that trailer again and again in many different circumstances. If you can't find a level spot upon which to park your trailer, you need to securely block the wheels to prevent a runaway nutmeg. If you know the ins and outs of the hardware and implements involved, you can pull off this trick in the dark or in the rain or both. Now, if you'll indulge me in a little curmudgeon time, the improved system on the nutmeg is a sizzling example of improving our technology and our gear right past the point of goodness and firmly into the realm of in one's own foot shooting, as I discovered the next morning, when I bounded bright-eyed and bushy-tailed out to the street to hook up the expedition to the nutmeg and launch Megan and myself and our charismatic poodle, Clover, upon our epic adventure. I backed the Ford into a close proximity for hitching, a process made infinitely easier with the advent of reverse-view cameras in vehicles, allowing me to single-handedly back up to the hitch with perfect accuracy. I hopped out of the driver's seat and skipped back to the trailer's third leg, which, in the case of our Airstream, was not a swinging manual affair, but instead a luxurious fixed leg that was raised and lowered by a hydraulic motor, making the process easy as pie. Here's the oh shit part. The hydraulic motor is powered by the Airstream's electrical system. The Airstream's electrical system that was now stone dead. If I couldn't raise or lower the leg, I couldn't hitch up for the trip. Okay, part of being dependable in such situations is being able to adapt and improvise in the face of adversity. I had weathered scenarios like this before and lived to tell the tale. So I was not panicking, but I was definitely offering the newfangled and dead luxury leg some rather choice epithets in praise of its sheer crapulence. Now, one reason I didn't panic is because I've been down this road before. For example, I had read that when an outboard motor won't start electrically on a boat, you can pop off the hood and there will be a pull rope starter option there for just such a dilemma. So you have to examine the problem from every perspective. Maybe if I couldn't raise the trailer hitch higher, I could make the ball hitch on the Ford go lower? I thought about rounding up all the neighbor kids and telling them to put stones in their pockets and then pile onto the tailgate. I also knew I could go down at least 5 or 6 inches if I let the air out of the back tires. Then, hang on! I remembered, beneath a pop-out cap, on top of the leg assembly, was a nut on the end of a shaft, and that nut had been engineered in that spot precisely to save my dumb ass in this very moment. I retrieved the nut-cranking wrench that came with the kit of sundry items that a very supportive camper daddy had talked me through when we bought this beauty, and I was all set to get back in business. Whoops. The aluminum propane cabinet was snugged right up against the back of the leg top, meaning that any wrench turning one might enact to manually spin the emergency nut would bang prohibitively into the cabinet. Okay, now maybe I began to feel some panic, and sweat began rolling down my unfortunately hairy torso. I had just commenced with formulating the explanations I would try to plead to Megan, and then started to think about which neighborhood I should move to, when she invariably dumped this sorry excuse for a husband, when a heroic shadow fell across my impotent wrench. It was the neighbor! Among his many laudable attributes, Adam maintains the sort of domestic garage that would make the craftsman tool people's hats fly off. Every necessary tool is represented, many dating back to his dad before him, beautifully organized and maintained. One particularly admirable aspect is his penchant for going the extra mile to seek out tools of quality that are manufactured in the USA. An enthusiast after my own heart, he updates me regularly when he discovers new sources of buying local, which works for table saws just like it works for beef and eggs. By and large, when any tool production moves overseas, the quality goes down so that somebody's wallet can get fatter, which is why I want to be like the neighbor and buy American whenever I can. He also has shelves and shelves of fasteners and washers and gaskets, assorted rolls of tape, plumber's strap, angle iron, and mending plates, beneath rafters bristling with stores of PVC pipe and conduit and scrap wood trim. But the most important element in his garage is its life. He is not a mere hobbyist or collector. In the decade or so that I've known him, he has built two different exterior decks and assorted gardening stations, fixed his roof, and completely remodeled his kitchen. He is a superhero exactly because he scrutinizes and maintains the readiness of his garage for just such a moment as had befallen me. The fire of delight that illuminated him when I explained the situation was that of a thoroughbred who is finally about to be set free to do what he was born to do, run. His first pitch, and it was a good one, was to chalk the appropriate 5/8-inch socket into a beefy hammer drill, notch it onto the nut, and use its powerful motor to spin the leg shaft. The only problem was that the torque required to raise and lower the 8,000-pound trailer only by turning this diminutive nut was considerably more muscle than even a hammer drill could provide. If we ever did deduce how to successfully turn this nut, it was going to be an arduous job for the turner. The neighbor was waylaid by this setback for all of 10 seconds. "Hang on," he said as he jogged into his lair of sufficiency, garage, clanged a few things around, and came jogging back. He held in his hand a 12-inch steel extender shaft, the end of which would receive the 5/8-inch socket, effectively sticking straight up off the leg shaft another foot. And the other end of the extender rod received the original cranking wrench, now raised above the impedimentary propane cabinet, allowing the wrench to rotate with impunity. The neighbor had done it again! Now, all that remained was for me to crank that extended wrench rig around and around for way too many revolutions to get the nutmeg's tongue high enough so that I could back the expedition's ball hitch beneath the trailer's connector. I'm not going to equivocate here. This exertion was goddamn hard. It required the engagement of my full body to juxtapose my weight against the lateral pushing and pulling of the crank, but it was working, and that meant that I would get to stay married, so I heaved away like I've never heaved before. Despite all the trials and tribulations of the last day, we were ready to go. Epilogue. The first time I stopped to refill my propane tanks in Arizona, I discovered that the aluminum propane cabinet was pretty easily removable by unfastening one large interior nut, which would have allowed the cranking wrench to clear just fine. Please don't tell Adam or Megan. Chapter 16. Virgin Flight. And we're off. Finally on the road by lunchtime, after losing most of the morning to the laborious trailer leg issue and other last-minute items, I was sopping with sweat, engaging in some deep breathing to ready myself for the next 9 or 10 hours on the road. I was in a state of emotional and physical exhaustion, with which I imagine the parents of young children must be well acquainted, fighting some sort of truly existential battle, emerging victorious but just barely, then picking oneself up and starting a full day in that state of both triumph and fatigue. After the hustle and fret around the dire circumstances of the hitch difficulty, followed up by a bout of exercise that I would liken to pulling a vehicle up a hill toward oneself by means of a rope, which one grasps hand over hand and heaves and tugs in a stance that can just barely be maintained in terms of stamina and balance, I was feeling quite spent. Performing just within the limits of one's strength capability for 20 or 30 minutes, say, will leave even the most enduring of mules ready for a nap. This is hardly the time you want to get on the road, but as any self-respecting jackass will tell you, I was going to be goddamned if I was going to be defeated on day one of our love trip by a hardware problem. This degree of stubbornness has served me exceptionally well in my life, excepting the time I tried wrestling a California king-size mattress up a staircase for an hour and herniated a disc in my spine. But guess what? That mattress is upstairs getting slept on regularly. So who's the stupid one now, mattress? Since one of the characteristics of Los Angeles that best defines her is her traffic, the way stink defines a skunk, driving away from the city always evokes a pure and lovely feeling, getting out into the open desert and feeling the wind in your hair, even if it's the sedate version where we just kick the AC up to 4 or maybe 4.5. As we barreled eastward in our 13 to 14,000 pounds of elephantine rig, once you've added the SUV and the nutmeg together, I was, as I said, awash with emotion. Physical depletion would have to be dealt with later, certainly, but for the moment, what I mainly felt was elation. Megan and I had both been dealing with our own personal flavors of depression. I have previously asserted, in this book and elsewhere, that my general happiness depends upon my ability to accomplish good, productive work that does somebody some good. Whether it's as an actor or writer or woodworker or son or husband or neighbor, I have had very good luck over the last few decades and almost always having been able to be of good use to someone. Having the vocational side of this personal economy stripped away from me then was quite alienating and left me feeling useless and adrift. When the pandemic began, all forms of work, well, with the exception of writing this book, instantly disappeared. But I'm grateful that I was still needed by Megan to fill my role as spouse, or I would have been truly in peril. Now, 8 months had passed, and we were breaking out of the cocooned malaise that had clouded our household for too long. I sat up tall in my massage parlor of a seat, placed my hands in the neighborhood of 10 and 2, checked the Ford's gauges, checked the extended side mirrors that I had purchased the day before and installed, gazed briefly at the most beautiful woman I had had the fortune to come across, and our magnificent little pup, Clover, who, in all sincerity, ran our household, then cast my gaze forward, permitted myself a modest smile, and proceeded to keep her tween the ditches for another 400 miles. Besides the triumphant travel mates in the passenger seat, there was another reason for the elation I was feeling. And for once, it wasn't meat-based. The sensation was not dissimilar to the way that riding a bicycle never fails to make me feel 12 years old again. Wind whipping through my hair. Apparently that's my thing. Now I'm trying to remember if I ever felt pleasure without a top breeze. as though I'm out of school and getting away with something. In this case, the eventual success of the morning, specifically with regard to making the equipment work, combined with the now, so far, successful operation of said equipment, brought me straight back to the times as a teenager that I was entrusted by my dad or my uncles on the farm to transport or operate heavy, expensive equipment, or coax an older model tractor or pickup truck into starting up and behaving amiably until the work was done. Over the years since then, I put in a lot of hard work, and I mean grueling physical labor, as a carpenter and as a theater actor, carrying the good-looking people on and off stage, and then as a woodworker, before my dream of success as an actor really took root in my mid to late 30s. After that, things began to change in profound ways for me, pretty much all for the good, but still, it's complicated. For example, when I suddenly had juicy acting jobs for most of the year, that really cut down on my time in my woodshop. So my dream was finally coming true as an actor, but my beloved second vocation was being diminished. Practically speaking, I was also working jobs that required a lot less physical labor than when I was at the shop 3 weeks out of every month. That meant my hands grew softer, and my diet also had to be streamlined since I wasn't burning as many calories slinging slabs of trees around the outfeed table. The irony is not lost on me that even as I was becoming well-known to television audiences as a fictional edifice of masculinity and physical fortitude named Ron Swanson, in real life I was growing softer by the day, metamorphosing from rough laborer into artist. It's not a big deal to me either way, as I was previously happy at the woodshop and I'm happy now in front of the camera, but it is a life shift of which I remain aware, partly because I enjoy returning to the shop when I have time between artist gigs. With that in mind, everything about this journey was reawakening the dauntless explorer in me, the part of me that was always the guy enlisted to drive moving trucks for friends from Champaign-Urbana to Chicago to New York City or Los Angeles, as well as up and down the coast of California. It felt amazing, and I never would have had the wherewithal to make it manifest if Megan hadn't cooked the whole thing up. The big fat life lesson in this for me is that things can go too well. I had happily settled into the extreme comfort of high-end acting jobs, and it was going well enough that I could pretty much fill the calendar. Sounds amazing, right? What's the problem? A little idiom I like to call too much of a good thing. Megan and I come from places that have actual weather, and 4 full seasons of it to boot. Oklahoma for her, Illinois for me. And so one thing we both dislike about Southern California is that the weather is way too nice, way too often. For one thing, it means your ecosystem is usually choked with drought. But just spiritually, the famous sunshine, day in and day out, is too much of a good thing. I love a well-marbled cowboy steak, medium rare, off the cast iron pan on the grill, but I don't want that for dinner every night, because then it's no longer special. I had stumbled my way into a life where I was getting the acting job equivalents of California sunshine and nightly steak for dinner, which I think would have taken me way too long to realize had we not been brought up short by the COVID-19 pandemic. Even so, it took my magnificent life curator bride to kick me solidly in the behind and plunk that behind into this diamond-studded massage chair of a driver's seat. We were about to spend a couple of months on the road together, a choice that had no motive beyond sharing a romantic adventure and getting to see her people in Oklahoma and mine in Illinois, which immediately brings to mind the Aldo Leopold family's ethos of exploring their land around their shack for reasons of agrarian fidelity and familial love, fully in the knowledge that they wouldn't be getting paid for it. So, here we were. Thanks to my childhood training, the loving support of our neighbors, and the astonishing ability my wife has for picking things out. It had been some years, but I was deeply grateful to realize that I was once again intrepid. Our ship's crew was depending on qualities in me that hadn't been tested for a while, and by Hermes, God of the Road, that's a feeling that will keep me young. In the last few weeks and months, as I mentioned, yet another area of expertise in which Megan had been matriculating was the ins and outs of RV parks. Our first destination was a gorgeous establishment called Catalpa Canyon in Cottonwood, Arizona. Megan had meticulously researched the place and secured us one of their newer spaces with what was truly a spectacular view. We had received a welcome email from the park office with instructions for arrival and whatnot, although I hadn't looked too closely at the fine print beyond pick up your welcome packet at the guardhouse and proceed to your assigned space, and sweet Danny Trejo, have you kids picked an absolute doozy of a sight? Cut to, totally forgetting about the time change to the mountain time zone, we rolled up to the guard shack at about midnight. Once we flagged down the excellent on-duty Dana Carvey character, who eventually came coasting silently along in a golf cart, we were duly informed by him, let's call him Merv, that we were intensely shit out of luck. Lesson one. The better RV parks have quiet hours, usually from like 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. or so. This makes a ton of sense because you're basically a temporary village of sometimes dozens of vehicles, all parked within yards of each other, often equipped with an assortment of caterwauling children and their bicycles, scooters, water cannons, video games, and so on. All things of which I'm generally in favor, but then we all want to get to sleep at some point as well. Lesson 2. Quiet hours means you can't drive your thick-ass Ford Expedition with a turbo V6 pulling a thicker-ass Airstream Globetrotter into the park, where, even if you're heavily experienced and smooth as butter, getting parked and set up is still a rigmarole that involves some inescapable noise. Lesson 3. Read the goddamn welcome email. If we had done so in this case, we would have known that if we didn't get settled in by 10 p.m., we would be shunted over to a side parking lot with no hookups. This would come to be key terminology in our lives as streamers. In fact, it was the first thing one asked of a prospective campsite. Do you have full hookups? What is meant by this term? Full hookups indicates that your site has the previously discussed outlet for your 50-amp or 30-amp electrical connection. It features a hose spigot with fresh water, which you may attach to your onboard water system, and it has a 3-inch drain plug in the ground to which you can attach your black water sewage drain pipe, also commonly referred to as your stinky slinky. Sometimes your site will also have a coaxial cable connection to hook your trailer up to cable TV. Usually these amenities are grouped together close to each other, and when everything clicks into place and works properly, it can feel pretty dreamy. You park your nutmeg, and within 10 to 15 minutes, it can be a fully functioning, cozy little land submarine. On that first night, however, I'll repeat, we had no hookups. We might as well have been in any parking lot anywhere for all the good this place was doing us. Oh, and it was cold. It was November 15th, and we were in the high desert, closer in feel to Flagstaff than Phoenix, so it was in the ballpark of 36 degrees outside. And let me now also remind you that we had no goddamn electrical power. Ha ha! What a dependable captain I was turning out to be. The trickle charge from the expedition to the Airstream batteries while we drove was not nearly enough to overcome the severe depletion I had laid on the system while it was parked at our house. At least we had a propane furnace. Lesson 4. Whoops. Know your systems. Maybe you're savvy to these things and you were already saying, "Why don't you just fire up the propane heater?" I thought the same thing, pal, okay? And once again, the answer to the question is death by technology update. If it had been just a propane furnace that had a pilot light I could even light manually, we would have been golden. But no! It's a way more deluxe, modern appliance hooked up to an electric thermostat and electric starting mechanism, which unfortunately requires electricity. Lesson 5. When you have no electricity and it's night in the desert, look up. Holy Gila monster, the Milky Way was like a vast psychedelic puddle of sparkling galactic vomit, to make a figure of speech. It was truly overwhelming, and we stood chest to chest and looked up and held our amazing dog, and then we slow danced. I can't recall if one of us played a song on our phone or if the music was just in our heads. Either way, we had gone through a hell of a lot to get to this pitch-black, freezing parking lot where we were, by God, still in love. So, that was the situation. We ate some cold pasta that Megan had prepared for the drive, and Clover had her dinner. A proper scout, I usually have a few choices for you, should you be looking for a flashlight, and Megan had some very cute little battery-powered globe lamps. Using these, we got situated and climbed into bed as soon as we could, which, thanks to Megan's talent for draping sleeping quarters in the finest linens, stuffed with the most magically warm goose feathers, was toasty and cozy as hell. When we awoke the next morning, it was still hilariously freezing, and we were like a couple of little icicles tucked under the covers. We sprang into action, buttoned up the nutmeg, and rolled into the park proper, catching Merv just as his overnight shift was ending. He gave us our welcome packet and a map, directing us to our long-awaited little slice of heaven, an RV site that we like to call C-48. As we wended our way through the park, passing all manner of recreational vehicles, Megan began to suspect something was off. She didn't recall the site number being so high as 48. We continued to pass different groupings of sites with varying situations vis-a-vis the vista, but all looking at something marvelous across the expanse of Arizona desert. It was around then that the road began to wind downhill and curve into a sort of canyon, but really it was more of a ditch. There was a distinct feeling that we had passed through the good spots and zipped right past the okay spots, because now we had clearly arrived at the shitty spots. We found our number, and this site was of a style that I would come to relish, known as a pull-through. This means that it was a strip of land big enough to accommodate all RVs and trailers, with a little yard to spare, and each end of the site was bordered by road, allowing the renter to drive into the site, park, recreate, then, once they had done their worst, to drive right out again, never being required to back that son of a bitch into a tight spot between other RVs. So, I actually drove around the loop of road a couple of times to eyeball my final approach, as this was my very first in-the-wild landing of the nutmeg. Once I had gotten my dander properly up, I slowly rolled us into place and threw the Ford into park. Megan was on the phone, but I hardly noticed as I sprang into action, engaging our nifty Airstream-shaped Mirth delivery system. I hooked up all the hookups, which was a bit fraught, since they were located almost directly beneath the pop-out bedroom of our next-door neighbors. It then began to occur to me that this rather intimate proximity to them was not ideal at all, and as I circumnavigated the trailer, I clocked some more details. We were parked in a tight corner of the lowest end of the property, and our views were basically of the other trailer homes and what appeared to be a not very attractive neighborhood. I unfolded her little two-step staircase and climbed it to enter the nutmeg and began unfastening all of the items lashed down for travel. Okay, here's a difference between Megan and me. People like these, right? Differences? When we're traveling in any capacity, and we have accomplished all the required legs of the excursion, meaning the drive is over, or the train journey with required taxis on either end has ended, or let's just say, pack, car to the airport, check in, go through security, flight, invariable Dallas layover, impossibly long tram ride, connecting second flight, baggage claim, car to hotel, check in, get safely to hotel room with luggage accounted for, okay? When all of these steps have been achieved, and we are legitimately exhausted, I don't care if there are no linens on the hotel room bed, or the bathroom is gross, or the window is shattered and rain is blowing straight into the room, I have finished traveling. Whatever the problem is, we'll be fine. We're done with the airport, we're done carrying bags, we've achieved the planned itinerary. One upper corner of the bedroom is filled with hornets. Not ideal, but not a deal breaker. You don't bother them, they won't bother you. I will sleep just fine. Time for a beer. Because she is a domesticated, civilized person, this is not the case with Megan. When something is wrong with our room, she rightly spots it, first of all, as I have already begun to lightly snore on the bed, and she then takes the immediate appropriate action, for which I always initially damn her, but finally thank her. I mean, come on! If she weren't so right about these hotel iniquities, I could be tipsy and drowsing by now. Why did I have to marry such a quality person? Just then, Megan stepped up and into the nutmeg with a full head of steam and a spirit fit to bursting with both piss and vinegar. It finally began to dawn on me that we had been given the wrong spot right about when she said, "They gave us the wrong spot." She was waiting for the guy to call her back, and she was really upset. In terms of keeping things fresh, one of our main techniques as a couple is when either of us has the opportunity to plan something as a treat or surprise for the other, we give it everything we have. Megan, as a truly sophisticated picker-outer of shit, is especially great in this arena, which means that she spends a lot of time doing a lot of research and legwork into any place we will be staying. If we were taking a trip to London, she would canvass friends and co-workers to learn which was the freshest, most flavorsome of the Kit Kemp hotel family. Then she would glean all the atmosphere she could online and learn which category of suite was best suited to our peculiar tastes, but then she would get somebody on the phone and grill them about which of the five suites had the best idiosyncratic details. A weird cool balcony, a real antique stone fireplace, a house elf. So, of course, she had trained the crosshairs of her considerable acumen onto the category of RV park spots. As she explained to me, waiting for the guy to call, the websites for these places were generally very thin. Perhaps this is because many of these places established their particular panache, or lack thereof, before the internet took over. So, whereas we're used to seeing way too many pictures of any given location, the RV parks thrive in something of a shroud of mystery. As Megan pointed out, there is often literally one photo on a given website, perhaps of a tree or a colorful rocky vista. For that reason, she had spent the duration of many phone calls trying to suss out the ideal spot for two lovebirds and their magnificent poodle. When the guy, let's call him Gary, when Gary finally called back, he and Megan figured out that she had indeed reserved for us a spot called K4, which, when we later went and looked at it, was nothing short of glorious. The problem was, Gary explained, that a few months ago she had reserved the spot for 3 nights here in November. But since then, another camper with member status had wanted K4 for 2 weeks, and since they were members, they automatically were given priority treatment. Megan had Gary on speakerphone, and at this last assertion, we just looked at each other in disbelief, jaws agape. It turns out this campground, Catalpa Canyon, was an almost heaven resort, meaning it was one of 178 such campgrounds dotted around the U.S. of A., where you could get similarly shafted in a cheery tone. Megan collected herself and asked him if that was standard business practice, specifically that the company wouldn't honor a reservation if a bigger fish came along. And if so, why wouldn't they at least contact us to let us know of the situation? Gary, confusingly, could not have been happier to explain that, oh yes, now he understood our befuddlement. What we had failed to do in the weird, apparently unprecedented case that we wanted our reservation to actually hold our space in reserve was to pay an extra $75 holding fee on top of the deposit we had been happy to pay. I guess we didn't know about that extra deposit on top of the deposit practice? Or we apparently should have just become members, which costs, I just looked it up, $615 annually for one of 5 zones. Meaning you can rest assured that your reservation will be honored in the appropriate fifth of our nation. Oh, sorry, did you want to actually travel when you, travel? Well, extra zones can be unlocked for $65 a pop. This is simply a different method by which they would receive extra money from us, and only then would we have been treated with what we have come to understand in most American business dealings as decency. This strangely chipper guy really did seem to feel for us, because we were clearly just rank greenhorns, entirely out of our depths in terms of RV park street smarts. He told Megan then and there that he would refund our money, and he even recommended another nearby campground that would likely have a nicer spot for us. Megan gave me a skeptical look, because it seemed that at some point one of Gary's co-workers might have written him a note that said he was talking to a reasonably popular television comedy legend, and that's when he turned his friendly dial up to 11. I unhooked our hookups, and we drove away. Lesson 6. When it comes to navigating RV parks and their gatekeepers, there is a substantial culture of unwritten laws of the jungle, and these customs can only be mastered by loading up your nutmeg and charging straight into the heart of darkness. Chapter 17. Angel Fire. Sure enough, we safely moved 15 minutes down the Verde River from Catalpa Canyon RV and Camping Resort to Verde Ranch RV Resort. Megan had called ahead on the brief drive and secured us a space, which I went and confirmed inside the office gift shop once we rolled in. Two very nice ladies and I, all of us in masks, managed an affable transaction using my credit card and copious applications of hand sanitizer. One of them had spoken to Megan on the phone some minutes earlier, and they had correctly determined that the place for us was down by the river under some giant broad-leafed cottonwood trees, where there were several available spots. A word on personal preferences. In this particular case right here, I couldn't for the life of me comprehend why the first spots to be snatched up wouldn't be the ones down by the river, under the shady deciduous trees. The majority of the other lots were then by default up a slope and out in the blazing sunshine, and they were pretty much all taken. I know I just spent some considerable page space describing the way in which my smart wife and myself were proven to be dumb and uninitiated in the ways of the camper mafia, so maybe you're thinking, down by the river is great if you like mosquitoes, dumbass, or something in that range. Well, that did not prove to be the case. Our spot was without a bloodsucker in sight, and frankly, just plain wonderful once I had successfully backed into it on my third try. This, thankfully, always happens to us. We are not beach people, and we don't crave the sun in any locale. Instead, because we miss the drama of the varied weather systems under which we were raised, we love to go stay at oceanside resorts during the off-season. This works out great, because everything is cheaper and less crowded, and if our luck holds, we might even get to enjoy some rain. Perhaps this condition, meaning our proclivity for selecting the alternate choice, had something to do with what makes us artists. We're the strange kids who like to sit in the back of the school bus and make up a secret language. Whatever the case, it had certainly landed us in a sweet spot, 378, with full hookups that felt like the most soothing of salves upon the wounds of the previous 12 hours. We set up camp and spent the next couple nights in relative bliss, answering Clover's bidding and exploring our first RV camp. What a difference was made by the merest shift in attitude from the first exclusive park, wielding unwritten rules that had completely rained on our parade, or, I guess, given our preference, shown clear weather down on our parade, to the second campground, where the administration simply treated us like neighbors and dealt with us squarely, invoking no bonus fees. As a well-off, middle-aged, straight white couple in America, I can't imagine anyone ever withstanding the painful discrimination and suffering that we had just experienced and living to tell the tale. After our success beneath the cottonwoods, we got back on the road and pointed the expedition northeast, hoping to travel 8 hours and then some to the mountains above Taos, New Mexico. We were feeling free and optimistic once more, having stumbled and regained our streamer feet. Megan had wisely phoned ahead to confirm our upcoming park reservations, and sure enough, this next one, called Angel Fire RV Resort, had done the exact same thing as the first place. A longer reservation had arrived, so they shoved us to a new space, presumably in the basement or out behind the tannery. The woman on the phone assured Megan that our new spot was virtually as good as the old spot, and Megan had their site map up on her smartphone and was apparently pacified by the woman for the moment. The Angel Fire manager also openly admitted that, yes, for a $50 fee, they would have locked our reservation in place. We drove through Albuquerque and on to Santa Fe, where we stopped at a charming little chocolate house called Cacawa. This was not a cute little bonbon shop. It was hardcore. Their passion, they say, is authentic and historic drinking chocolate elixirs. These include traditional elixirs from pre-Columbian, Mesoamerican, Mayan, and Aztec cultures. Some elixirs from 17th century Europe, plus some from colonial America and colonial Mexico. And I'll tell you what, Their top drawer hot chocolate beverages were so delicious and invigorating and innovative and irresistible that we went out of our way to get back there two more times before leaving New Mexico. Blended with powerful cacao and chili powders, theirs was the perfect reborative beverage to power us up the last couple hours of our wintry drive in the high desert. When we arrived at Angel Fire, it was after quiet time again, but they luckily allowed late-night entry. I snagged our welcome packet hanging from the guardhouse doorknob, and we silently rolled into the expansive field of RV sites, but something was off. As we drove along, navigating by the site map I had just acquired, the moon was bright enough for us to look all around us in disbelief. We sallied forth farther and farther into the park, until finally, in the farthest corner, we saw the large RV that had taken our reserved spot and no other campers. We had been bumped from our spot in an RV park in which we were the only occupied spot. Oh, sweet Gaia, how we laughed. We did hoot and holler as we rolled to our newly secured spot a few down the row from what was apparently the unquestionably greatest spot in the state of New Mexico. Hot damn. But these RV people were strange. The next morning we awoke to an inch or so of light powder covering everything. As I walked in uncertain clover around the almost entirely empty park, my education and streamer life proceeded apace. This was a very nice, almost brand new facility, evidenced by its version of the building I would come to learn as a staple of RV parks, the shower laundry house. The one at Angel Fire was really nice. The bathrooms were spacious, and there were a few very nice stone-tiled showers, each in its own private room. The laundry facilities were clean and brand new, and there was a fire pit behind the building with all-weather furniture and a robust gas fire going, which was pretty extravagant in the light 28-degree snowfall. One gratifying part about living in the Airstream is the ability to haul your domestic comforts anywhere you can park that thing. This sometimes feels thrilling, as to a child. Like when you're out in the woods all day and return home dirty and tired, and you can take a hot shower in the diminutive but totally functioning shower. Or when you're road tripping and you pull into a gas station to fill up. But the bathroom situation looks pretty skeevy, especially during COVID, and you can just pop in the back and use the bathroom that you happen to be hauling around with you. That said, it's also pretty cramped in there, which is sometimes fun and sometimes less than. That made these shower buildings pretty golden, especially when there was nobody else around. Streaming is a blast, but it's also nice to be able to scrub off all of the algae without making your wife listen to the scraping. On our way back, a couple new camper units had arrived, one of which was a gigantic motorhome, and the other was a fellow Airstream, a newish-looking flying cloud. It was funny, the way we humans operate. Just seeing the same brand of trailer made me feel an immediate esprit de corps with the owner, despite not even having seen them. Megan and I enjoyed a cozy breakfast with a dazzling view of the snow-blanketed mountains before I disconnected the Ford from the Nutmeg so that we could head down to Taos and walk around. When we got there, only a handful of lonely